Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and tonight we have a special program featuring the winners of the Writers' Cafe contest, sponsored by the Writing Center of the University of Pittsburgh. With us tonight are five writers reading their winning pieces of poetry, fiction, and creative nonfiction. And we'll also talk with writer Keely Bowers, who will talk about the Writers' Cafe and the Writing Center. We'll begin with first place poetry winner Jade Shames. Jade Shames is graduating from the University of Pittsburgh with a BA in creative writing. Based in Philadelphia, Jade has read his poems both locally and internationally at such venues as the Philadelphia Concerts for Peace. Hi, Jade. How you doing?
Good.
It's good to have you here. So go ahead with your prize-winning poetry, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
This is called The Saddle Maker. I have cousins in South Africa, relatives in Russia, the Middle East, Brazil, Philadelphia, the wandering Jews making footprints in different shades of earth. My dad told me the story, how we all got here in bits of unused leather and scrap metal, and made lives far from Kiev and the house of the saddle maker. My great-great-grandfather bought hide and steel and crafted carefully. Every stitch worked to perfection, every bit of color soaked into the skin, the horn of stag, polished, billet strap woven by hand. When the saddle was ready, it was carried to the market. A year's work, tightly knit and caressed, the blevins, the swell, the signature concho, all fit for the riding horse of a czar, all sold for enough to last another year. One day, the market fell on Passover, and my great-great-grandfather refused to go. The Seder that night was quiet, and the saddle maker's many children exchanged stares, eating until painfully full, plotting the upcoming year. This next one I'm going to read is called Teeth. After millions of x-rays are pumped into my face, I try to recline on a recliner, but it isn't working. The dentist has a highlighter face down in his white shirt pocket, and I can't stop staring at the huge yellow stain. Should I take him seriously? He's ragging on my teeth, my half-dead and dying, hole-filled, crown-covered, ground-down, highlighted teeth. There's a pond outside the window that's supposed to keep me calm, and it does. The water sky blue, and beyond it, the freeways lined with palms. My dentist back in Philly has a view of a rusted gate and some dead leaves on an old sumac. I need to move to L.A. and switch dentists. The L.A. dentist with plaques around his office, degrees from schools I've heard of, and a highlighted heart, keeps calling to attention the tooth that may fall out at any moment. Don't eat the apples. I want to ask him if he knows that any dream analyst will tell you that teeth are connected to identity. I want to ask him if he knows what all of this means in terms of that. Is there anything I can do? Is it all the flying, the travel, the constantly changing girlfriends, the death in the family, the brown cardboard boxes with everything I own stuffed inside, always being jostled around, my new bedsheets, my haircut? Will there ever be peace and balance within and without my body? And he responds, without knowing all the things I want to ask. I understand, really, but hey, you should see some of the people that come in here. Unfixable. This one's called Dresden. A friend of mine told me that she knew a POW in Dresden during the World War. The camp was underground, and it was the only way they survived what must have sounded like an endless thunderstorm. The POWs were in charge of digging pits and bringing the bodies together and lighting everything on fire. When I build a fire, I can smell the bark of the oak branches or the dead maple leaves, the crackling sound of moisture. And as it burns down, the air is saturated with different shades of smoke. I can smell the pine sap and the ink of the crumpled up newspaper I used for tinder. I absorb what the fire slowly eats, what was absorbed by the allies and officers as the light danced off their faces and made their shadows into huge tree-like silhouettes. And this last one I'm going to read is called The Companion. It's from my chapbook that I sell during my readings. There was once a mountain in my backyard where I would roam and conquer that stretched out past my property and into a vast desert wasteland. My traveling companion was 6 years old. We met in kindergarten. She wore a purple hairband and white stockings the day she asked me about God. My dad told me that God was in everything. He said that God made things alive. He said that God was everywhere. And she told me that if God were everywhere, that we could find him, and I believed her. On the mountain out back, we walked slowly, our arms stretched out, our fingers spread and poised. We closed our eyes and waited to touch him. "Come quick," she said, "right here." I ran over to her, her fingers froze in a spot in the air. Surrounded by miles of gray trees and dead grass, I put my fingers near hers and struggled to feel what she did. But I couldn't close my eyes to concentrate. I couldn't take them off of hers as they glowed a sharp green and exploded like a rainforest, like a holy land. And she smiled her little wonderful secret smile as she spoke. "I found him."
Okay, that's Jade Shames, first place winner of the Writers Cafe Poetry Contest. Nice poems.
Thank you very much.
What's the name of your chapbook?
It's called Momentum.
Okay, great. Always say the name of your chapbook.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we also have Keely Bowers here with us. Keely Bowers teaches fiction and creative writing at the University of Pittsburgh. She won the Nelson Algren Award for short fiction, and her work has appeared in Crazy Horse, Creative Nonfiction, and the Dickinson Review. She and Alan Smith run the Writers Cafe, sponsored by the Writing Center at the University of Pittsburgh. So, Keely, can you tell us what is the Writers Cafe? What's the contest about?
Well, the Writers Cafe meets roughly every 2 weeks at Pitt's Writing Center and is open to all University of Pittsburgh students. We end up having a lot of students come to the Writers Cafe who are not in formal creative writing classes, but who are very interested in creative writing. And we have guest speakers who come in and talk about writing, poetry, creative nonfiction, fiction, and offer some creative writing exercises for the students. Sometimes the students workshop, bring work to talk about, with the other students in the cafe. It's very informal, is meant to just, you know, be a place for the students to just, you know, come and write and think about writing and talk about writing. And like I said, a lot of the kids aren't in formal writing classes. We have kids in sciences and business even and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that this began a couple years ago with Ellen Smith started it, the
yes.
poet Ellen Smith. And it's really, it's amazing how it's grown and sustained. And this is, I think, the third or fourth year we've done the Writers Cafe contest here on Prosody. So can you talk about the growth of it? And do you have food at the meeting? You have pizza and
we have
pop or something?
We have light refreshments.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, it has really, it's been a great thing because it has, you know, we weren't sure how, you know, how it was going to go at the beginning or what kind of interest we would get. And this is, I think, our fifth year with the Writers Cafe. As you said, this is about the fourth year that we've done the contest. So every spring we have a creative writing contest for fiction, creative nonfiction, and poetry. And then we also offer at the end of the fall semester a reading where the students can, anybody who wants to read something they've, you know, worked on in the Writers Cafe can come to the Cup and Chaucer and read. So it has. It's just continued to draw interest, and we get a lot of kids. It's been really good.
That's great. And also, you know, these students are lucky to have, you know, writers like you and Ellen Smith here with You're such accomplished writers and teachers at this point. Do you always show up at these things, or, you know, like you said, you have guest writers, guests? I know that one week you invited Carlo students, and do you have some people coming from the outside?
Yes, we invite outside readers, outside speakers, other writers from the community.
Like that. Well, it's a great program, and I just want to say thanks for doing it, because I know this, a lot of great writing comes out of it, and the students are excited about it, and we're happy to hear them every year. So thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guests tonight are the winners of the 2008 Writers' Cafe contest from the University of Pittsburgh. The first place fiction winner in the Writers' Cafe contest is Rachel Brickner. Rachel Brickner is a junior at the University of Pittsburgh studying literature and writing. She's been published in Scottish University's International Summer School Literary Journal called Northern Light, and hopes to pursue a career teaching and writing poetry and fiction. Hi, Rachel. How are you doing?
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're excited. So go ahead.
The name of this piece is You Will Know Elasticity. You hate the smoky vanilla smell of your quaint suburban home. Your father's passed out and snoring on the couch, his mouth hanging open like an infant. The colors from the TV project onto his broad face while the images change on the screen. Your mother walks around you into the kitchen. She turns a rerun of I Love Lucy on the small white television atop the kitchen counter. You hear the movement of a chair and the crack of a lighter. Lucy's laughter spikes the sound of the newscaster's melancholy voice facing your father. The overwhelming noise of all the voices is like loneliness. It reminds you of Catholic school when adultery was just another word you didn't know, barely mentioned as you and 10 other kids pass the stations of the cross, Jesus with that heavy burden on his back, and Sister Catherine asking you to recite the Ten Commandments, echoing throughout the dark church. You sit next to your mother in the kitchen, watching Lucy embrace Ricky. "Oh, Ricky, you're wonderful," Lucy says like a parrot. Your mother laughs. "Did you eat yet?" You pour yourself a glass of milk and shake your head. "I'll make you a sandwich then." "Ham," she says. "No, that's okay. You haven't had a bite of ham in years." Sitting at the kitchen table, you stare at the television with a look as blank as the white bread in front of you. Your mother laughs at the screen without ever looking at you, sipping her coffee and smoking her cigarettes one after another. You sink your teeth into the fluffy bread. The lettuce crunches like burnt crust as your teeth melt into the cheese beneath it, and you wonder many things, like how a wall can divide three people so completely, and you ask her, "Why haven't you left him?" But you really want to scream. "Why would you ask me this?" she says. "I don't know," you say. "No, you don't," she says, looking at you, and you can hardly breathe. "Finish your sandwich," she says. You watch your mother sitting there, smoking, hunched over and frail, and your chest tightens because she is sad and beautiful, and you wonder if you will be like this someday, if this isn't who you already are. And you ask yourself, is it she who has changed, who is less happy? Or is it you who has come to see things more clearly now that you are older? You hug her before you leave the room. You do this because she is tough and cynical. You do this because she loves that you are not. You do this because she loves that you love her, that you have to because you are hers. On Monday, it was midnight and the playground was empty. The wind was warm and dusty and the trees whistled like they wanted you to play. Their half-naked branches swayed like ripples, like an ocean in the sky. Nothing but a street lamp lit the swing set you were sitting on. Jim looked at you and laughed as he bobbed back and forth on his swing like a buoy in water. You both stared out past the hill the playground was on, overlooking a field surrounded by tall, burly trees, and the sky was as dark as canned olives. You pumped your legs like it was survival and jumped from your swing seat in the air, laughing as you stumbled on the wood chips beneath you. Your cheeks burned from the strain of smiling for so long. "We should go for a ride," he said. You wanted to ask where you would go, but it didn't matter. All was different and light, and the warm air smelled sweet like someone was baking apples. You asked him if you could drive, and he scrunched his nose like he did when he cleaned the make line. The fallen vegetables, cheese, meat, and pineapple mixed at the bottom of the cooler, creating the smell of vomit. "I'm a good driver," you said, opening the passenger door. "You barely have your license," he said. You sat down and pushed 5 empty cans of Arizona iced tea to make room for your feet. The cushioning, dashboard, and floor were covered with receipts, and it smelled like salt and sliced tomatoes. "Do we ever not smell like pizza?" you said. "I don't think so," he said. "I don't even know the last time I saw you outside of work without just leaving it." You felt empty as he rolled his window down and put a tape in because it reminded you of where you used to be, what it was like when you were 15, how you watched him in the same high school halls day after day without knowing him. His face was like a young boy's with big eyes, and his body looked frail and vulnerable. He reminded you more of a girl than yourself, with your broad shoulders and thick thighs, and in some way you wanted to be him as much as you longed to be with him. Driving through the city tunnels, you looked at him and smiled, allowing yourself to bend. The A side of the tape ended, and it was quiet. The soft buzz of the city lights, wind, and car felt like electricity shooting through your ears as you tried to let go of yourself and relax as you were before, not wanting to become so hard and scared that you break like your mother. "You will know elasticity," you told yourself. "You will learn to bend without breaking into pieces so small that you can't put yourself together again." Jim flipped the tape. A song came on that sounded like nothing you've ever heard before. It was slow and stiff and made you feel like you were balancing on the phone lines above you. You felt warm and happy as a ball as thick and dense as dough rose in your belly, and you wanted to hug or scream or kiss him because you were afraid of melting into someone you didn't know and of what he could see. You never thought you'd be known. The car sailed up a large hill until Jim parked against the curb and pulled his keys from the ignition. "Ready?" he said. You followed him across the slanted sidewalk to an ivy-covered railing. He bent over it and turned towards you. "Come here," he said, and reached for your hand. "Look." You stood on your toes and bent over the railing as Jim clenched your hand like a child's. The city skyline illuminated each ripple of water, and you imagined the shiny flecks floating through the waves as extraordinary jellyfish, living only in this river, in this moment. You wished you could feel the water on your skin as you bent over, its pressure filling and collapsing you, only for you to rise again like the time your father pulled you from the ocean. Your lungs filled with salt water, and he said, "It's okay, breathe," and your mother watched, frantic, with her feet in the coarse, dry sand. Then you stood, and Jim's lips touched yours, and you forgot everything, because this was your first kiss, and you wondered how it would feel for so long, and it was a little wet, but your mouth was too dry and nervous to know if it was good, and part of you thought it wasn't real, because someone was here before you, and it would have been okay if you just stared at the jellyfish and imagined what it would be like to really love him. If you could call him something that sounded like your own, like father, mother, or boyfriend. But those roles weren't even very clear anymore, were they?
That's Rachel Brickner, first place winner in the Writers' Cafe contest, reading her work. Well, I really loved the emotional savvy of that piece.
Thank you.
Nice details.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, next up we have first place creative nonfiction winner, Grace Amoros. Grace Amoros has recently left a 25-year career in database management to try her hand in writing. Last year, she won second place in creative nonfiction in the Poets Cafe contest. Hi, Grace. How you doing?
Hi, Jan. Good.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay.
My essays are about my dad, and I'll read a few. They sort of weave themselves into a story. Anton. My dad heard voices. I still search for him, like a tongue going back to a missing tooth. Dead for 17 years, sometimes he roams around in my head where I talk to him. Born on the winter solstice, this December 22nd, he would have been 100. His birthday is 1 month after his first great-grandchild is expected to be born. I told him about the baby and asked for prayers. My son and his wife are naming the baby Anton after my dad. Ever since I knew this, it has become essential to me that this child know his namesake. So essential that it has grown into a passion. Sharing most of my dad's stories with a baby will be easy. An athlete, an entrepreneur, swimming, roller skate rides, double dip ice cream cones, and unconditional love. I can even tell him about dad's bizarre driving and weird fix-up projects. He often let the child inside of him come out to play. I recall the book of Genesis, where God took a rib from Adam and created woman. Bone of his bone, flesh of his flesh. Blood of his blood, I contemplate the baby's lineage. What do I tell him about the voices? Revelations. This man who heard voices was the only dad I ever knew, and as I grew older, I was certain that something was wrong, but I never knew what or how to fix it. So I immersed in my own life and pushed it aside. One Wednesday morning in the fall after Dad died, I awoke with flu-like symptoms. My stomach hurt like someone had kicked it. In bed, I crawled toward the phone that was on the nightstand and called off work. I buried deep inside the covers. Hours later, feeling funky and Betty Davis bored, I went to the closet for a robe. On the floor, under my green furry slippers, was a black cardboard box. My mom gave it to me a couple of weeks after Dad's funeral. I forgot that I had it. I dragged the box beside the bed, plopped down on the floor next to it, and rummaged through. I thumbed a black leather book and saw the words, "Pool Hall Expenses," written inside. There were handwritten scripts scrolled across the columns, like a writer's journal. Next to the ledger was a pile of stockbroker memos dated 1952, and underneath lay a tidy stack of papers. It looked like the remains of a book Dad was writing and never finished, or if he did, pages were missing. Papers held in Dad's hands, now in mine. I felt like I touched him and started to read. He heard comments of many walking past him in the opposite direction, but never so that he could see the person who was talking. In the theater, two certain people had moved their seats. It was obviously intended for him to hear. Constant irritation. There's Nikolai. He almost went crazy. Unmerciful pounding of these thought waves which molested him with their terrible repetition. To describe the process was impossible. To him, it meant hell here on earth. "Enough," I said. I threw the papers on the floor. Dad's relentless pain was spilled all over the pages. Hands wet and clammy, my shoulders started to shake and tears leaked down my cheeks. What had I done? Feeling hollow and depleted, my body dropped limp and I sat stupefied on the floor. After what seemed like infinity, I gathered the papers and carefully placed them back in the box, and I banished it in the far corner of the closet, where I couldn't see it, and covered it with a towel, as if to bury it. And I crawled back in bed, dug my head under the pillow, coiled my legs up to my stomach in denial. I called off sick for the rest of the week. Banishing the black box forever from my mind would prove impossible. Searching for Oz. A decade and 7 years have passed. The baby is coming. A balmy September night sky smiles bright and cheerful, and I relax in the backyard with a couple of Mom's biscottis. The anise taste is strong, and I remember it's a favorite that I shared with Dad. A squirrel dashes across, but not before Maggie spies it. Her basset hound ears flap, and she barks and chases the furry tail up the rotted apple tree. She sits at the bottom and waits. I decide. In the morning, I will do it. It was time. The black box was still inside the closet, where I pretended that it didn't exist. I wiped the dust from the dry, cracked lid. The cobwebs flew off, and the memories flooded in. I was determined and reluctant to reconcile Nikolai Ratev as Dad. A deep sigh escaped my belly. I read every page until my head ached. I grabbed an almond Hershey bar, Dad's favorite, and headed outside. On the trail, I kicked a stone and watched it roll zigzag in the dirt. I imagined the road was bricked yellow and would lead me to the Oz for answers. Perhaps courage would come along the way. Sometimes I hear voices, doesn't everyone? Annoying and rude, they murmur things like, "You're too fat, too short, stupid." What made me think that Dad's voices were any different? I quickened my pace and ruminated on what I knew.
That's Grace Amoros, first place creative nonfiction winner. Thank you so much, Grace. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guests tonight are the winners of the 2008 Writers' Cafe Contest from the University of Pittsburgh. Next up, we have second place fiction winner, Julie Sokolow. Julie Sokolow is a part-time musician and full-time student of psychology and fiction writing at the University of Pittsburgh. She was recently awarded a Brackenridge grant for her project entitled Reconstructing the Suburban Tragicomedy. Hey, hi, Julie.
Hi, Jan. I'll be reading the first part of A Reservation Off the Parkway. Donald burrowed his face under Jane's arm and clamped his nose between her breasts. Jane's nostrils whistled as she ran her nails through the curls of Donald's hair, tracing circles in his scalp down to the folds of his neck. Donald wondered why the minutes before waking seemed estranged from the rest of his minutes. Only when the milky yellow light started to drift in did Jane's wrinkles seem to unfurl and fingers become delicate. Donald gazed up at the crust in the corners of Jane's eyelids. He dragged the comforter up over their heads. "What are you doing?" Jane muttered. Her fingers scratched at the polyester. Donald exhaled warm fog and clutched her hips. "You want to suffocate the both of us?" Jane said, and kicked the comforter off the bed. She squatted and yanked open the curtains. Donald squinted at the particles of light whizzing around Jane's white underwear. Donald thought Jane looked like a pelican as he sat in bed and watched her dress. Swooping under gray cotton, she tugged her tights up her legs with her jaw jutting out at him. Donald swam under the sheets and molded his knees into his stomach. His lips vibrated and spluttered. "Are you humming?" she asked, gripping his shoulder and pressing her ear against his cheek. "What are you humming?" "Don't worry, be happy." "You sound like a dying bumblebee." Donald's humming dwindled to a low buzz as Jane shuffled through hangers in the closet. "I'm not your mother," Jane said and dropped a suit on Donald's head. He peered through his dress pants at Jane closing the door behind her. He tucked his stomach under his belt and strapped suspenders over his chest. Jane had bought the suspenders for Donald on one of her mall trips. She had wrenched his belt out of the loops in his pants and told him that his gut sagged so much it looked like it was frowning. She had said that suspenders were kind of like a corset for older men. Donald stumbled down the stairs and leaned against the threshold of the kitchen. He crept up to the table and sat watching Jane climb the stepping stool up to the top shelf of the freezer. Jane had insisted on renovating the kitchen, and now the refrigerator was taller than Donald. Something about its height and metallic shine made him nervous. At night, he wondered if anyone had ever been buried in a stainless steel refrigerator. "Don't think that this is for you," Jane said as she lowered a white cake to the marble tabletop. Ever since Donald had stopped running, Jane made sure he had become aware of his weight gain. Sometimes she would tug on handfuls of his stomach and tell him he could use an abortion. Other times she would stand up from the table when he was done eating and hover over Donald until he was done too. Donald watched Jane's dress swirl around her knees as she flung open the silverware drawer. She poked 8 candles into the cake, and Donald spread his elbows out on the table. He cupped his face in his hands. "Am I boring you?" Jane asked. Donald sat up. He looked out through the sliding doors at the shrubs and weeping willows. He wished there was a pool there instead. He wished there was a deep end for him to dive into instead of flat land. Jane had said that she didn't like the idea of a hole being dug out of her property. "You look half dead," Jane said. "Then I must look half alive," Donald muttered under his breath. Donald pivoted his chair against the tile and watched Edith gallop in. Edith had frizzy red hair and breathed with her mouth wide open. Donald thought she looked primitive, like she didn't belong in a stainless steel kitchen. Some of the kids in school called her Chucky. Edith had never seen a horror movie, so she grew to like the nickname. Once she even told Donald to call her by it. He said he would, as long as Jane wasn't around. "Happy birthday, Edith," Jane said, bending over the cake and lighting the candles. Donald peeked above the loose neck of Jane's dress at the bones in her chest. Edith sat across from Donald with her freckled arms spread across the table. Jane inched a placemat towards Edith until her arms fell into her lap. Jane sang and Donald mouthed the words. Jane glared at Donald like he had altogether missed his cue. Whenever Jane looked at him, he felt like he had forgotten something. "Blow out the candles," Jane said. "Why?" Edith asked. Jane crossed her arms. "If you don't, the house will burn down," Jane said.
It's the writing of Julie Sokolow, second place fiction winner. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been the writing of the winners of the Writers Cafe contest, sponsored by the University of Pittsburgh Writing Center. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. The sound engineer tonight is Amy Sutton. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.